Support for The Full Story comes from Long Wharf Theater, creating theater of, for, and by the people of Greater New Haven. Everyone's story has a place at Long Wharf. You belong.
Studying the inside of a smashed atom is big news for Long Island's economic future. And Connecticut says it's looking for a big bang and brighter future for its manufacturing sector. Welcome to The Full Story. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks for being part of our show today, which has two components to it. Now, in part two, we're going to be talking with Colin Cooper. He's been asked by Governor Ned Lamont to help manufacturers in Connecticut, and we're going to have that discussion with Colin Cooper in about 15, 20 minutes or so from now. But we're going to start today by talking about some exciting scientific and economic news which concerns our region. And that is, the Brookhaven National Lab, BNL, in Upton, has been chosen by the Department of Energy, the DOE, to be the home of the DOE's electron-ion collider. Now, to explain this, we're bringing in Professor Abe Deshpande. Professor Deshpande is a professor of physics at Stony Brook University, and he's a senior fellow at the Riken BNL Research Center. Professor, welcome. It's good to have you here, sir. Thanks for your time.
Glad to be here.
So for mere mortals, such as myself, what does an electron-ion collider do?
So the electron-ion collider is a device where we use the electron as a probe to probe inside of the nucleus, protons, all nuclei that are at the core of the atom. In measurements of this kind of physics, you want to make sure that you're probing something that is uniquely inside the target. So in this case, the proton or the deuteron or the nuclei are the target, and the electron is the probe. Because electron has absolutely no structure, whatever comes out of that collision, we are sure, is a representation of what goes on inside the atom or inside the nucleus. So this is the critical part that an electron-ion collider does. What we want to really look at is inside the proton, there are these quarks and gluons. The gluons are binding these quarks very tightly together to make sure that they don't run out of that proton or the neutron. And we want to understand how these interactions happen, how these quarks are confined inside the proton. What are they doing? How are they moving? What are their interactions amongst them? So that's the primary goal of this electron-ion collider, to really get to know these interactions from inside.
When this is built, will this be the only one of its type in the world?
Yes, it is rather unique. It is currently, there is absolutely no competition to this machine. There are plans to build or at least hopes to build certain machines in Europe and perhaps in China. But other than that, in the next foreseeable future, this is the first step. This is rather unique. It has two properties. One of the things that we want to hold when we do experiments with such machines is that we want to control all the situation, all the variables in the collision. One of them is a polarization or the spin alignment of the proton beam. And that is rather unique. There is really no competition to the current day RIC, the relativistic heavy ion collider, where we are going to base this electron ion collider for. This is the only place in the world which we have demonstrated high energy polarized, meaning spin controlled protons. And also we have nuclei running through it, zipping at light speed. So to have these two things with the variables that we can control experimentally and in an accelerator, it is rather unique, and one of the things that we are very proud of, that this will be a world-leading facility, but also a unique facility where people from all over the world will come to do experiments with.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Professor Deshpande, Abe Deshpande, who's a professor of physics at Stony Brook University. Professor, can you describe what the collider will look like when it is finally built?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Can you describe what the collider will actually look like when it's finally built?
Okay. So I don't know whether you and the audience has visited RIC, the Relativistic Heavy Ion Collider. It's a 3.8 kilometer perimeter machine which sits inside the Brookhaven National Lab. It has the ring, the what we call tunnel. Currently, it has two beams in which there are counter-rotating nuclei, and then there are places where they collide. The plan in building the electron-ion collider is to insert in that same tunnel an electron beam facility that will then collide with one of the existing RIC beams. And so it will from outside, it will not look any different other than this electron beam facility inserted into the same tunnel. And then in the experimental areas, we will have these collisions of this electron versus the polarized protons or the nuclei, whatever the experimenters would need. So that's how it will look like.
Now, this tunnel, for we Americans, it's 2.4 miles?
It's about 3.8 kilometers, yes, in perimeter, yes.
Okay, and it's one story underground from what I was reading?
Well, it is almost. I mean, you can see the footprint of it. It is not underground. It is on the ground, but it is covered with cement and dirt. So you can actually see it if you fly out of Islip or JFK, and the flight is low enough. You can actually see this extremely impressive instrument of science as you fly in and out of local airports.
Professor, how long will it take to build this, and how much is it going to cost?
So currently, the estimated cost is somewhere between 1.6 billion to 2.6 billion U.S. dollars. That's the construction cost expectation that has been projected and defined by the Department of Energy. We think that we can build such a machine in about 10 years. So the first collisions could happen somewhere around the turn of the next decade, around 2030 or so. That's about the timeline it will take.
Professor, why was Brookhaven chosen? I mean, why did you come out on top?
That is very difficult to say. This is something both Jefferson Lab and Brookhaven were asked to make proposals, and they were evaluated by external committees, and that information has gone up. The actual decision process, we don't know. I think that's a question really for the DOE to answer.
Professor, what do you think? Will scientists be moving? I know they've already come to Brookhaven many times, and it's a world-class facility, but will more scientists be moving to this region because they want to be part of what you're doing?
Yeah, I think it will be an attractor for the brightest minds in the world who want to study this quantum chromodynamics, or the study of what happens inside the proton. I think it's very natural that young people, young scientists from all over the world will come to do experiments here. 20 years ago, I moved to Long Island because RIC was there, and I stayed here. I'm pretty sure some of the scientists of the next generation will come and stay, but not all will stay. I think a lot more will visit more often than not. Visiting for a few months and establishing themselves for 4 years as the experiments are being set up or constructed. So that's a very natural process that happens in a large collider environment, that the intellectual leadership of that field from all over the world arrives there and stays for short to long terms. I mean, it's different people choose to do different things, but that's correct.
Professor, do you have any dreams of what this may mean for our future? I ask that because one of the press releases said, and I'm going to quote from it now, it said, "This may trigger technological breakthroughs that have broad-ranging impact on human health and national challenges." I mean, that's setting the bar pretty high, isn't it?
That it is true. But, these kind of technological advances, for example, this machine is going to be state of the art, and beyond state of the art issues will come in. What that will mean is that the technology that we'll have to develop to realize all this, and when it gets real, will have broad implications, just not in our field, but outside. And the kind of things that people have talked about, as you said, was health and medicine, national security, nuclear energy, isotope production, and the use of particle beams in very, very different ideas. So, you know, for example, there is a suggestion and there is hope that these things will be used to test computer chips. The medical uses to kill cancer cells is well known. Particle accelerators are these days being used to design drugs of different kind. And of course, new material in electronics are being invented, made using these topic, modern technologies. The detector technologies that we will need to produce have direct consequences to medical needs as well as national security. And in general, I think computing facilities, we'll have a lot of data. And I think that data analysis will require new kinds of algorithms to detect particles in our detectors. And that has a broad implication outside of pure nuclear science. It could be used anywhere outside where large data pattern recognition techniques, et cetera, come in. So it is true that it always spills over. These technologies that are meant initially for science, or nuclear science in this case, will eventually, inevitably spill over and go into the society directly.
Professor, I only have 20 seconds left. I have to ask you, are you excited?
Oh, I am excited. I am super excited to make this real.
Professor Abe Deshpande is a professor of physics at Stony Brook University. He's a senior fellow at the Riken BNL Research Center. And Professor, more than anything, thank you for making this easy for me so I could understand. I appreciate that.
Anytime.
Thank you, sir. We'll speak with you soon.
Bye.
If you would like to comment on today's program, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. Facebook, find us at Full Story WSHU. And remember, the show is available as a podcast on Google, Apple, Stitcher, Spotify. We'll take our first break. We'll be right back. And it's the Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks for being part of the show today. If you want to join in, if you'd like to comment, you can email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU, and we are available as a podcast. Download the Full Story on Google, on Apple, Stitcher, Spotify. We are talking about the new electron-ion collider, which is going to be built on Long Island at the Brookhaven National Lab. It's not a stretch to say it's a feather in the cap for the region for so many reasons, one of them the economic benefits. Now we're going to bring in a regular contributor to our program, and it's always great to have him back, Professor Martin Cantor. He is the former Suffolk County Economic Development Commissioner, and he is now the director of the Long Island Center for Socioeconomic Policy. We're bringing the professor back because we want to talk about those economic benefits. Professor, I haven't spoken with you since last year, so Happy New Year to you, sir.
Happy year back to you.
Thank you. Economically, how big of a deal is this?
Well, first of all, it's a big deal. It's a very big deal. When I was commissioner for economic development, I always looked upon Long Island as having some very, very big assets in terms of the biotech research industry. One was Cold Spring Harbor's lab. And the other one was the Brookhaven National Lab, as well as Stony Brook University. And my plan was to make it a high-tech corridor, just like they have in Illinois, in Lamont, Illinois. There's another national laboratory in Illinois that creates a corridor that goes all the way up to Chicago. So I figured that if we could do that here, we would have a high-tech corridor that would go from mid-Long Island all the way through New York City. But there's a lot of politics to get any kind of new research and any kind of new dollars into these national laboratories. As you can see, 4,000 construction jobs that'll come with the expansion. That equates to about $200 million in construction wages. And the economic impact of that is about a secondary economic impact, about another $300 million. So this will be worth about $500 million to the Long Island economy over the construction period. And that's really big money. I mean, the Long Island economy itself is about $150 billion. That's the last estimate I saw. So when you consider it in the perspective of the Long Island economy, you know, you can consider it, you know, less than 1%, but that's a big number also when you consider how slow economic growth we see, you know, in the national level. It's like 2%, 2.5%. That's not inflation. It's considered excellent growth. So this is a big deal for the economy. The second thing that's a big deal is that without this money, about 1,000 high-paid jobs would be lost. The average construction job pays about $50,000 to the workers in their pockets, and the higher-paying technology jobs can be over $100,000 a job. So by having this, it retains those 1,000 workers. Plus, the unseen benefits are that we're going to attract a lot of international smart people, scientists, to come to Brookhaven, and that could spur off secondary small companies like former Grumman Aircraft did in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. So you have my rambling answer. It's a big deal.
No, it's a good answer, and I had a whole bunch of questions for you, and you just answered a bunch of them. So let me just take that paper and throw it away here. Professor, it occurs to me that this is all part of the economic transformation of Long Island, isn't it? I mean, the electron-ion collider, you got wind farms. You and I have spoken about this before. The wind farms, solar panel fields, the pharmaceutical industry. I mean, the change is happening as we're speaking.
Well, it is happening. You see, the big thing here is, when you talk about let's talk about the wind farm for a second. You know, that's, the governor had announced he wants to create an institute to train people for wind farming, but you know, government shouldn't be providing the institutes. That should come from the private sector. But the reality there is that there are people who are doing HVAC work. You know, that's home heating. Mm-hmm. Air conditioning, things like that. And as their jobs phase out, because there will be a phase out as we go from traditional forms of energy generation to wind farm, there's going to be a loss of jobs, and those loss of jobs will be filled by the wind farm. I remember a while back, about 8 years ago, I had done a study for the Long Island Power Authority on sustainable energy, and all other places in the country, including California, you find that there's a change in the job descriptions and the amount of new jobs that people expect to come from, like wind farm, you know, won't materialize as much because there has to be a place for the more traditional energy-producing companies to have their workers relocate. But that also is a big deal. And pharmaceutical, absolutely. Biotech, very, very big, but in the research part. But here's the kicker. When you research something, when you come up with an idea, you come up with something that you actually can put in a box and ship someplace else, that's where Long Island stumbles. Because of our high costs and the lack of infrastructure, that means sewage and things like that, a lot of the times that the researchers, once they produce something, they sell it. Once they get patented, they sell it to a manufacturer. And guess where 8 out of the 10 largest national manufacturers are located, pharmaceutical manufacturers are located?
Overseas?
No, over the Hudson River. It's in New Jersey.
In Jersey? No.
Yes.
Well, I meant to say over river, but, you know.
Yeah, I know. Over the river. You know, it is another country, New Jersey, but the fact is that New Jersey has it. So the key for Long Island is that when we research something and we have a product that you can manufacture, we have to keep that manufacturing process here so Long Island gets the value added of manufacturing and the higher paying manufacturing jobs. That's where we stumble, because our high cost of living, high cost of energy, high property taxes, it takes manufacturers, they go elsewhere. And I've done surveys of research and surveys of Long Island manufacturing base, and 30% of the companies say they're going to be off the island in 5 years. So that's what they're telling us. So that's the big challenge for Long Island.
I only have a minute and a half left with you.
Sure.
I just want to clarify because I have Connecticut's new manufacturing czar, who's going to be joining us in just a minute and a half.
Great.
His big thing is that he says manufacturers are telling him workforce development. Not enough kids are coming out of the schools who are trained with the skills. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that is one of the reasons that manufacturers cite that they're leaving, because you know they don't have the skilled workers. But let's understand something. That is the other point would tell you that supply and demand would tell you that if you can't get workers, then you're not paying them enough. And that's the other thing, is that manufacturers are cheap, and they won't pay kids the amount of money that, you know, this new workforce, the amount of money to be able to attract them to come from another region. Because of our high costs, you have to pay more salary so the people can live here and can work here. That's what they're not doing. So, and the other thing is, you just can't blame it on the colleges that we have to educate more. Colleges are businesses also. And if they don't have a recurring student body for this type of program, they're not going to spend the money or invest the money in teachers and in curriculum and syllabus. And I know that because I worked 5 years for the president of Dowling College. And we saw all this.
All right. Professor, I have to hold you there because I have to move on to our next interview. Thank you for coming on today. It's always a pleasure. We'll get you back soon.
Oh, do that. And thank you so much for calling. And I hope at least I shed some light on the questions.
Thanks, Professor. Professor Martin Cantor joining us. Thanks again, Professor. You're listening to The Full Story on WSHU, and you can listen to our podcasts. You can do that on iTunes, on Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, now we've spent the first part of today's full story talking about a particle accelerator and what that means for Long Island and our region. Now we're going to spend a few minutes talking about how the state of Connecticut wants to get its manufacturing sector to speed up. And for that, we're going to bring in Colin Cooper. Colin Cooper is Connecticut's first ever chief manufacturing officer. It's CMO. He was named to that position, I think it was back in October, by Governor Ned Lamont. And Colin Cooper, it's a pleasure to welcome you to The Full Story. Thanks for coming on today.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. Give us a synopsis. What is it that you've been asked to do?
Well, I'm focused, as you might guess from the title of my position, on the manufacturing sector in Connecticut. So, really, I've spent the first, I'm just about coming into 3 months into it, and really spent the first couple of months out in the manufacturing community, talking to different companies, meeting with a lot of the different manufacturing groups throughout the state, and trying to develop a priority list of issues, headwind issues, let's call it, that manufacturers face. And then from there, once we have a sort of a good sense of what they are and the priority, and then start working on developing, countermeasures to those issues.
It's a big job. It's a heady position. So what's your background? Why were you chosen?
Well, I started my professional career as an engineer. I was a design engineer for Pratt & Whitney a lifetime ago. And then I went to grad school, actually came out of grad school and went into finance and consulting for a period of time. And then a fella who I had become good friends with originally at Pratt, and he and I went to grad school together, always thought it'd be fun to own and run a manufacturing business together. And in the late 90s, we bought a small aerospace company up in northeastern Connecticut together, and managed to grow that fairly substantially over about a 20-year period. He and I were in a process of extracting ourselves from that business, and really, I was on a glide path towards retirement when the state came to me on this position, and I sort of threw my hat in the ring, and we went through a process, and as you mentioned earlier, I started in October. So I've got 20 years of experience of of helping run and grow a manufacturing business in Connecticut. So I've got a lot of sort of firsthand experience. And also I've been involved with a number of initiatives in the state, manufacturing initiatives. I've been on the board of the ACM, which is the Aerospace Component Manufacturers Group. And also I've been on the board of the MIF, which is the Manufacturing Innovation Fund, which is a state-funded initiative to develop and implement programs to support manufacturing in the state. So I've got experience both running the business as well as working with the state and different constituencies within the state.
Hmm. Are you a Connecticut native?
I sure am. I'm Connecticut through and through. I was born in Hartford. I grew up in New Britain. I ran a business out of Eastford, Connecticut, and I live in Glastonbury. So I'm about as Connecticut as they come.
So the reason I asked that, and I didn't mean to be too intrusive, it's because I was just traveling a little bit. You and I were speaking before we went on the air, and I was out on the West Coast. And so when I talk to people about Connecticut, they don't think about Connecticut and manufacturing in the same sentence, even though you and I both know Connecticut has had a long and a rich history when it comes to manufacturing. But when I mention Connecticut, they say, oh, Fairfield County, hedge funds. They say Yale. They talk about UConn basketball. Why is that? Because Connecticut, as you and I both know, as I said, does have a long and rich history when it comes to manufacturing.
Yeah, a long and rich history and a very strong presence today. I mean, our history in Connecticut really goes back to the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution in this country. The Connecticut River Valley really was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution in this country, and we continue to have a very vibrant manufacturing sector in the state today. I mean, you think about manufacturing in Connecticut, some people would think about, we've got some world leading companies here, companies like Sikorsky, Pratt and Whitney, now used to be Hamilton Sunstrand, it's Collins Aerospace now, Electric Boat. Those are all very well established and well known entities, and really leaders in the world in their products. But we also have a very diverse manufacturing base in the state. It may surprise you to know that there are over 4,000 manufacturing companies in Connecticut. So there are some very large ones that people are aware of, but there are every town has got manufacturers in it, and it's really one of the great things about my position is I get to get and visit these companies, talk with them about their issues. Two generations ago, when I was growing up in New Britain, the factories were very large sort of buildings in city centers. That has evolved, and now most manufacturing, at least in Connecticut, they're smaller companies. They're out in light industrial parks. They make something. Sometimes they're world leaders, but it's something that's not a brand name, so you wouldn't know about it. They make equipment for other manufacturing businesses, or they make parts that go into the jet engines or submarines. And some of these are world-leading companies that you just never would know are there because they're off back off the main highways and byways in the woods sort of doing what they do and doing it very well.
Hmm. I remember years ago, for those who know the city of Bridgeport, Bridgeport was well known around the world as being the place Bridgeport made the machines that made the machines.
Right, exactly. And there are still Bridgeports today. At least certainly the brand name is out there. It's not not necessarily the same as it was before and not necessarily made Bridgeport anymore.
Just out of curiosity, you shared with us your engineering background, and we have to take a break in a minute. But looking at the manufacturing, I'm not going to call it a problem, but a way to improve it as an engineer, do you say I have to do A and then B and then C like an engineer would?
I think the great thing about engineering is you learn to take big problems and break them down into smaller, hopefully solvable pieces. And, there are a number of challenges for manufacturing, and sort of my first priority is sort of try to understand what they are and prioritize them, and then help work with folks to develop solutions to those challenges.
When we come back, I want to talk to you about a documentary that I actually worked on for Connecticut Public TV. Gosh, it's now about 30 years ago, and it was called Made in Connecticut, and it had to do with manufacturing in Connecticut and what they were talking about back then, how to stop manufacturers from leaving the state and retaining the ones that they have here. So maybe we could touch on that. Could you stay with us for just a few minutes? I have to take a quick break.
Certainly.
Thanks, Colin. Hold on one second. Colin Cooper is with us. He is Connecticut's first ever Chief Manufacturing Czar. His title is CMO. And as he was telling us, he is there to try and get the manufacturers to stay in Connecticut and also to bring new ones in. If you would like to join in today's program, you could email us. We're tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU. And remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the full story on Google Play, Apple, Stitcher, or Spotify. Let's take our break. We'll be right back. It's the full story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. If you want to join in, you can email us, tfs@wshu.org, and on Facebook, we're at Full Story WSHU. We're continuing the conversation with Colin Cooper, who is Connecticut's first ever Chief Manufacturing Officer. It's CMO. Colin, I'm going to step back in time now because, like I was mentioning before the break, it was about 30 years ago I was doing work for Connecticut Public TV. And we did a program called Made in Connecticut. We actually did one Made in Connecticut, too, also. Now, this is going back three decades, and the business leaders, many of them back then, told me how they were going to move their manufacturing facilities out of the state because they said they had it with taxes and regulations. They wanted to take advantage of incentives from other states or other countries. And they also knew they wouldn't have to pay their workers as much if they moved someplace else. So what has changed since then? Has the atmosphere improved?
Yeah, I mean, those are still challenges. Connecticut is not a low-cost region for manufacturing or for living in general. We have a high cost of living. Our tax situation is sort of well documented. I think so. So what's happened in those sort of 30 year period is there certainly was some reduction in terms of the workforce in Connecticut. And where we've ended up today is we tend to be best here in Connecticut at what I would call high complexity, low volume manufacturing. So it's a lot of very sophisticated manufacturing that relies very heavily on the skills, knowledge, and ability of the workforce. So the people that are here manufacturing in Connecticut, by and large, are doing it because of the quality of the workforce that is here. The governor likes to speak of Connecticut as sort of the Silicon Valley of advanced manufacturing. And when you look at sort of the products and the industries where we compete very effectively, they are industries that are, very high, high-tech industries.
Mm. Do you have a list of the issues that you're trying to tackle? Can you give me your top five?
Sure. So as we discussed earlier, I've spent the better part of about 2.5 months out speaking with different stakeholders in the manufacturing ecosystem, business owners, people running businesses, meeting with a lot of different manufacturing groups throughout the state. The priority issue that really floats to the top with everyone is workforce development. The manufacturing ecosystem in Connecticut is right now it's relatively strong. These manufacturers have gone out, they've created demand for their product, and they've created jobs. What they're struggling with right now is finding people with the requisite skills to fill those jobs. And virtually every company I talk to has open positions where they're looking to get people to fill that. So first and foremost is workforce development. And then there's a litany of other issues. not necessarily in order, but you know, a lot of companies I talk to, access to capital is a challenge. Manufacturing is very capital intensive, especially advanced manufacturing, very expensive equipment, expensive products. Then you've got inventory and accounts receivable. So it's capital and working capital intensive, and growing businesses need capital to fuel that growth. So just making sure that these small to mid-sized businesses, 4,000 businesses, average size is well under 40 people. These are not, on average, large companies, making sure that they continue to have access to capital. Regulations is something that comes up. Every company's got it sort of a different, there's no sort of general one issue on regulations. Different companies have different issues, and we're trying to work with them to address some of those. Energy costs, and then sort of longer term, the identification and implementation of technology. There's a lot of new technology that's coming to bear. Most business owners, people running businesses, they're answering the phone, they're running equipment, they're making payroll, getting the product made and out to the customer by the end of the month. And so a lot of times they're looking, really at the challenges right in front of them, not necessarily looking out 5+ years and saying, what's coming at us? Where do we need to be in the next 5 years? And certainly I think the state can play a role in helping these businesses identify and implement new technology as it becomes available.
Mm. Could we talk a little bit more about workforce development? Because, and this goes back to a program we did, about a month and a half, 2 months ago. College student debt in the U.S. is around $1.6 trillion. During our program, some suggested that some students should possibly skip going to college, instead go to trade school and get a job in the manufacturing center or become an electrician or a plumber and so on. What do you think about that?
I think for a lot of folks that makes a ton of sense. The old perception of manufacturing, sort of dark, dirty, dangerous, dull, is just not up to date with where things are today. I've been in scores of companies over the last couple of months. You go into these places, they're well lit, they're organized, they're full of millions of dollars of computerized equipment, and they're not, the people running these businesses are not looking for button pushers, they're looking for problem solvers. So I really look at manufacturing as a great opportunity for young people to start a career. Not everybody has got the interest or sort of the financial wherewithal for another 4 years of post-secondary school education. You can go into some of the training programs and get some a portfolio of skills in a relatively short period of time where you can enter the manufacturing workforce and really begin a career. And if you look at the difference between spending 4 years accruing debt versus getting into the manufacturing environment and starting to earn money, by the end of those 4 years, you're way ahead financially. These are careers. I mean, I look at our business over the years on the people that young people we've brought in. They start in one position, and very quickly they're moving to another and to another, and to the point where we had a lot of very young people taking on a lot of responsibility, including managerial responsibility, if they had the interest and the aptitude for it. So I think for a lot of folks, that's a great idea. I think one of the biggest impediments we have is changing perceptions. The manufacturing community is trying to go out and get students to get into these businesses so they can see what's really going on there. And it's not just getting the kids in there. It's getting the educators in there and having them understand what the opportunities are. And the parents. The parents frequently are an impediment. Everybody seems to say, I want to have my kid to go to college. For everybody, that may not be the best choice to make. And again, getting people out there, understanding the opportunities, understanding what those work environments are like is an important priority for the manufacturing community.
What are we talking about in terms of salaries?
Well, it runs the gamut. I mean, it depends where, you know, for starting, you know, you can start anywhere from, you know, $14, $16, $18, $20 an hour, or even, you know, significantly more than that if you're going to work for a place like Pratt & Whitney. And then it can accelerate quickly from there. I know one of the things that we would remember, you know, we would hire some kid you know, out of high school who got some training in welding and starting him at one level, and then within, you know, several months having to bring him or her up, and then bring them up again and bring them up again as they acquire these skills. You've got to bring them to market. And somebody who's got sort of the feel for things on welding can increase their compensation very rapidly. And then if you look with these businesses, being busy, if you start working overtime, you have, you know, people at a very young age making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year on up from there. So it can be the compensation can be very attractive.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Full Story on WSHU, and we are talking with the first ever chief manufacturing officer in Connecticut, Colin Cooper. Colin, just to keep going with that conversation, even though it sounds great and you say, okay, look, you know, you can go to trade school and you can come into manufacturing and make those numbers, that's a good living. But there are many who are warning nowadays about artificial intelligence and robotics, and they're warning that many of the manufacturing jobs, or any jobs like a truck driver or even lawyers, those jobs are going to be gone within a few years. Does that worry you?
Well, I think that in any industry, you have to look at things. You know, productivity is sort of this relentless march. And, you know, throughout our history, and it's not just in manufacturing, you can look back 100 years in agriculture and see, you know, productivity comes on along. You're invariably every year doing more with less. But no, I'm not worried about manufacturing jobs going away. I think, you know, you look at the Connecticut workforce in particular, we happen to have a fairly aged workforce in manufacturing. 35% of our employees are over 55 years old. And so that's, you know, that's the age where, you know, 55 on is when people start thinking about retirement and then actually retiring. So if you look at sort of the demographics of our workforce or the age demographics of our workforce, then you make some assumptions on growth in manufacturing, and you make some assumptions in productivity, which offsets your need for people. We're still looking at the need for 6,000 to 8,000 people a year to enter manufacturing for the foreseeable future. So there's a real demand for people to get those skills, acquire those skills, so they can enter the manufacturing workforce. And it also, I think, for young people, creates a tremendous opportunity, because there's going to be this sort of this wave of boomers at more senior positions that are going to be retiring over the next 10 to 15 years, which is going to create opportunity for younger folks or mid-career folks, too, to move up. So there's sort of a built-in tailwind for these folks to bring them on along. So I'm pretty optimistic on for young folks in terms of what their career opportunities are going into manufacturing.
We have about 5 minutes left, so I want to squeeze in two more questions if I can. The other night I was watching Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang. He was on the Bill Maher show, and he has spoken a great deal in his campaign about his belief that the U.S. is going through the greatest economic and technological change in our country's history. And he's talked about at least what he thinks why this is happening. How do you see it? What's the biggest issue going forward? Is it automation, or is it maybe trade deals, specifically with China?
Well, I mean, I think the impacts of those two things are very different. Certainly trade deals have an impact sort of on the macro environment in terms of just overall demand. And then also, I mean, I think our manufacturing base in the U.S. in aggregate has been exposed to a lot of lower cost region, and that's had an impact on manufacturing over the last 30 years or so. But I think, you know, most of the manufacturing that has moved offshore to take advantage of those lower wages has done so. In fact, what we're seeing today is actually, you talk about technology and automation, the fact that automation is actually allowing us to back onshore some of the production that went offshore. And people are starting to learn that these long supply chains, supply lines, you know, out of Asia and other parts of the world, there's a cost with those, not only a dollar and cents cost, but also timing and control and whatnot. So you're actually starting to see some things. You know, we're not big textile manufacturers in the U.S. That was an area that got really sort of gutted with offshoring. You're starting to see that pieces of that coming back on in, and technologies allowing that to come back in. So those all play a role. And again, technology and automation is going to drive productivity in manufacturing, and that's going to allow us to make, you know, have higher output with less people. But that's a factor we're seeing everywhere. But yet, you know, I think you look at it in aggregate, I'm not worried. I think a lot of right-minded people are looking, saying our biggest challenge in the next 20, 30 years, not just in manufacturing, but across all industries and services, is getting enough qualified people to do what we need to get done, whether it's, you know, manufacturing or healthcare or insurance or whatever it is. It's, you know, the demographics are such that we have a lot of skilled people leaving the workforce. We need to train new entrants to enter the workforce. So, if I were a young person, actually, I would be fairly optimistic on sort of the career opportunities, not just in manufacturing, but across the board.
We have about 2 minutes left. So with that time, could you give us a vision? If everything goes right for you and your plans, what does Connecticut's manufacturing sector look like, let's say, 10 years from now?
Well, I think, you know, I think our biggest challenge is workforce related. Right now, we have the demand for workers in manufacturing. I estimate, you know, 6,000 to 8,000 people we need a year going into manufacturing. Right now, we do not have the training infrastructure in place to train that many people. There's a lot of great work going on in that regard. I think we need to, you know, focus on that and accelerate our ability to increase our training capacity. And I think long term, again, Connecticut, you look, we're not the lowest cost tax state. We're not the lowest cost energy, don't have the lowest cost health care. And I'm never sure that we're lowest cost of living. I'm not sure that we're ever going to get there, nor do we want to be the lowest cost in everything. There's a great quality of life here. But I think what we need to do is focus on making sure we compete based on our workforce, that we have the best workforce in the country, in the world, for the things that we do. And if we can, if we can continue to get a pipeline of talent into manufacturing, people with the right abilities and the right skills, I think that we can have a very vibrant manufacturing ecosystem, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Colin Cooper, he is Connecticut's first ever CMO, Chief Manufacturing Officer. Colin, thank you. We appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
If you want to join in and comment on today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, and on Facebook, you're going to find us at Full Story WSHU. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Franks, the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer, and Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of the Full Story.